was the case, sure, I would bide. But if not... He hesitated, glancing toward the door where Joseph had so abruptly disappeared. Do you think I might have some chance of overcoming a father's objections? Perhaps if I was to find some way of coming by a bit of money, or if it was to be a question of religion. He looked a little pale at this, but squared his shoulders resolutely. I think I should be willing to be baptized Romish, and he required it. I meant to tell him so, but forgot. Would you maybe say so to him, sir?
Aye, I will, Jamie said reluctantly. You've quite made up your mind as it's Lizzie, then, have you? Not Malva.
Bobby was taken aback by that.
Well, to be honest, sir, I'm that fond of them both. I'm sure I should be happy with either one. But, well, truth to tell, I'd be mortal feared of Mr. Christie, he confessed, blushing. And I think he don't like you, sir, while Mr. Weems does. If you could speak for me, sir, please.
In the end, even Jamie wasn't proof against this guileless begging.
I'll try, he conceded, but I promise you nothing, Bobby. How long will you stay now, before you go back to Lord John?
His lordship's given me a week for my wooing, sir, Bobby said, looking much happier.
But I suppose you'll be going yourself tomorrow or next day.
Jamie looked surprised.
Going where?
Bobby looked surprised in turn.
Why? I don't rightly know, sir. But I thought you must.
After a bit more cross-talk, we succeeded in disentangling the tale. He had, it seemed, fallen in with a small group of travellers on the road, farmers driving a herd of pigs to market. Given the nature of pigs as travelling companions, he hadn't stayed with them for more than one night, but over supper, in the course of casual talk, had heard them make reference to a meeting of sorts, and speculate as to who might come to it.
Your name was mentioned, sir. James Fraser, they said. And they mentioned the ridge, too, so I was sure 'twas you they meant.
What sort of meeting was it? I asked curiously. And where? He shrugged, helpless.
Took no notice, ma'am. Only they said 'twas Monday next.
Neither did he recall the names of his hosts, having been too much occupied in trying to eat without being overcome by the presence of the pigs. He was plainly too occupied at the moment with the results of his unsuccessful courtship to give much mind to the details, and after a few questions and confused answers, Jamie sent him off. "Have you any idea?" I began, but then saw that his brows were furrowed. He obviously did.
"The meeting to choose delegates for a Continental Congress," he said. "It must be that."
He had had word after Flora MacDonald's barbecue that the initial meeting place and time were to be abandoned, the organisers fearing interference. A new place and time would be established, John Ash had told him. Word would be sent. But that was before the contretemps in downtown Cross Creek.
I suppose a note might have gone astray, I suggested,
but the suggestion was a feeble one.
One might, he agreed. Not six.
Six?
When I heard nothing, I wrote myself to the six men I knew personally within the Committee of Correspondence. No answer from any of them.
His stiff finger tapped once against his leg, but he noticed and stilled it. They don't trust you, I said, after a moment's silence, and he shook his head.
Little wonder, I suppose, after I've rescued Sims and tarred Neil Forbes in the public street.
Despite himself, a small smile flitted across his face at the memory.
And poor wee Bobby didn't help, I expect. He would have told them he carried letters betwixt me and Lord John.
That was probably true. Friendly and garrulous, Bobby was capable of keeping a confidence, but only if you told him explicitly which confidence to keep. Otherwise, anyone who shared a meal with him would know all his business by the time the pudding came. Can you do anything else to find out? Where the meeting is, I mean. He blew out his breath in mild frustration. Aye, maybe. But if I did and went there, there's a great chance they would put me out, if not worse. I think the risk of such a breach isn't worth it. He glanced at me with a wry expression. I suppose I should have let them roast the printer.
I disregarded that and came to stand beside him. You'll think of something else, I said, trying to be encouraging.
The big hour candle stood on his desk, half burned, and he touched it. No one ever seemed to notice that the candle was never consumed.
Perhaps, he said meditatively, I may find a way. Though I should hate to take another for the purpose.
Another gem, he meant. I swallowed a small lump in my throat at the thought. There were two left. One each, if Roger or Bree and Jemmy. But I choked that thought off firmly. What does it profit a man to gain the world, I quoted, if he lose his soul? It won't do us any good to be secretly rich if you get tarred and feathered. I didn't like that thought any better, but it wasn't one I could avoid. He glanced at his forearm. He had rolled up his sleeves for writing. And the fading burn still showed a faint pink track among the sun-bleached hairs. He sighed, went round his desk, and picked a quill from the jar.
Aye. Perhaps I'd best write a few more letters.
Chapter 60 The Pale Horseman Rides. On the 20th of September, Roger preached a sermon on the text, God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. On the 21st of September, one of those weak things set out to prove the point. Patrick and Hortense McNeil and their children hadn't come to church. They always did, and their absence aroused comment. Enough that Roger asked Brianna next morning if she might walk round and visit, to see that there was nothing wrong.
I'd go myself, he said, scraping the bottom of his porridge bowl. But I've promised to ride with John McAfee and his father to Brownsville. He means to offer for a girl there.
"Does he mean you to make them hand fast on the spot if she says yes?" I asked. "Or are you just there to keep assorted Browns from assassinating him?" There had been no open violence since we had returned Lionel Brown's body, but there were occasional small clashes when a party from Brownsville happened to meet men from the Ridge now and then in public.
"The latter," Roger said, with a small grimace, "though I've some hopes that a marriage or two betwixt the Ridge and Brownsville might help to mend matters over time."
Jamie, reading a newspaper from the most recent batch, looked up at that.
"Oh, aye. Well, as I thought. Does not always work out just so, though."
He smiled.
"My Uncle Colum thought to mend just such a matter with the Grants by marrying my mother to the Grant. Unfortunately," he added, turning over a page, "my mother wasn't inclined to cooperate. She snubbed Malcolm Grant, stabbed my Uncle Dougal, and eloped with my father instead."
Really? Brianna hadn't heard that particular story. She looked enchanted. Roger gave her a sidelong glance and coughed, ostentatiously removing the sharp knife with which she'd been cutting up sausages.
"Well, be that as it may," he said, pushing back from the table, knife in hand. "If you wouldn't mind having a look in on Patrick's family, just to see they're all right."
In the event, Lizzie and I came along with Brianna, meaning to call on Massali and Fergus, whose cabin was a little way beyond the McNeils. We met Massali on the way, though, coming back from the whiskey spring, and so there were four of us when we came to the McNeils' cabin. "Why are there so many flies all of a sudden?" Lizzie slapped at a large blue bottle that had landed on her arm, then waved at two more circling round her face. "Something's dead nearby," Massali said, lifting her nose to sniff the air. "In the wood, maybe. Hear the crows?" There were crows, cawing in the treetops nearby. Looking up, I saw more circling black spots against the brilliant sky. "'Not in the wood,' Bree said, her voice suddenly strained. She was looking toward the cabin. The door was tightly shut, and a mass of flies milled over the hide-covered window. "'Hurry!' The smell in the cabin was unspeakable. I saw the girls gasp and clamp their mouths tight shut as the door swung open. Unfortunately, it was necessary to breathe. I did so very shallowly as I moved across the dark room and ripped down the hide that had been tightly nailed across the window. "'Leave the door open,' I said, ignoring a faint moan of complaint from the bed at the influx of light. "'Lizzie, go and start a smudge fire near the door, and another outside the window. Start it with grass and kindling, then add something, damp wood, moss, wet leaves, to make it smoke.' Flies had begun to come in within seconds of my opening the window, and were whizzing past my face. Deer flies, blue bottles, gnats. Drawn by the smell, they had been clustered on the sun-warmed logs outside, seeking entrance, avid for food, desperate to lay their eggs. The room would be a buzzing hell in minutes, but we needed light and air, and would just have to deal with the flies as best we might. I pulled off my kerchief and folded it into a makeshift fly swatter, slapping to and fro with it as I turned to the bed. Hortense and the two children were there, all naked, their pallid limbs glimmering with the sweat of the sealed cabin. They were clammy white where the sunlight struck, legs and bodies streaked with reddish-brown. I hoped that it was only diarrhea and not blood. Someone had moaned, someone moved. Not dead then, thank God. The bed coverings had been thrown to the floor in a tangled heap. That was fortunate, as they were still mostly clean. I thought we'd better burn the straw mattress as soon as we got them off it. "'Do not put your fingers in your mouth,' I murmured to Bree as we began to work, sorting the feebly twitching heap of humanity into its component parts. "'You have got to be kidding,' she said, speaking through her teeth, while smiling at a pale-faced child of 5 or 6, who lay half-curled in the exhausted aftermath of a diuretic attack. She worked her hands under the little girl's armpits. "'Come on, lovey, let me lift you.' The child was too weak to make any protest at being moved. Her arms and legs hung limp as string. Her sister's state was even more alarming. No more than a year old, the baby didn't move at all, and her eyes were sunk deep, a sign of severe dehydration. I picked up the tiny hand and gently pinched the skin between thumb and forefinger. It stayed for a moment, a tiny peak of greyish skin, then slowly, slowly began to disappear. "'Bloody fucking hell,' I said softly to myself, and bent swiftly to listen, hand on the child's chest. She wasn't dead. I could barely feel the bump of her heart, but wasn't far from it. If she were too far gone to suck or drink, there was nothing that would save her. Even as the thought passed through my mind, I was rising, looking about the cabin. No water. A hollowed gourd lay on its side by the bed, empty. How long had they been like this, with nothing to drink? "Bree," I said, my voice level but urgent, "go and get some water, quickly." She had laid the older child on the floor and was wiping the filth from her body. She glanced up, though, and the sight of my face made her drop the rag she was using and stand up at once. She grabbed the kettle I thrust into her hand and vanished. I heard her footsteps running across the dooryard. The flies were settling on Hortense's face. I flapped the kerchief close to shoo them away. The cloth skimmed her nose, but her slack features barely twitched. She was breathing. I could see her belly, distended with gas, moving slightly. Where was Patrick? Hunting, perhaps. I caught a whiff of something under the overwhelming stench of voided bowels and leaned over, sniffing. A sweet, pungently fermented scent, like rotted apples. I put a hand under Hortense's shoulder and pulled, rolling her toward me. There was a bottle, empty, under her body. A whiff of it was enough to tell me what it had contained. "'Bloody, bloody fucking hell,' I said, under my breath. Desperately ill and with no water to hand, she had drunk Applejack, either to quench her thirst or to soothe the pain of the cramps. A logical thing to do, save that alcohol was a diuretic. It would leach even more water from a body that was already seriously dehydrated, to say nothing of further irritating a gastrointestinal tract that scarcely needed it. Bloody Christ, had she given it to the children too? I stooped to the elder child. She was limp as a rag doll, head lolling on her shoulders, but there was still some resilience to her flesh. A pinch of the hand, the skin stayed peaked, but returned to normal faster than the baby's had. Her eyes had opened when I pinched her hand. That was good. I smiled at her and brushed the gathering flies away from her half-open mouth. The soft pink membranes were dry and sticky-looking. "Hello, darling," I said softly. "Don't worry now. I'm here." And was that going to help, I wondered? Damn it all, if only I'd been a day earlier. I heard Bree's hurrying steps and met her at the door. "I need..." I began, but she interrupted me. "Mr. McNeil's in the woods," she said. "I found him on the way to the spring. He's..." The kettle in her hands was empty. I seized it with a cry of exasperation. "Water! I need water! But I... Mr. McNeil, he's..." I thrust the kettle back into her hands and shoved past her. "I'll find him," I said. "Get water. Give it to them, the baby first. Make Lizzie help you. The fires can wait. Run!" I heard the flies first, a buzzing noise that made my skin crawl with revulsion. Out in the open, they had found him quickly, attracted by the smell. I took a hasty gulp of air and shoved through the buckbrush to where Patrick lay, collapsed in the grass beneath a sycamore. He wasn't dead. I saw that at once. The flies were a cloud, not a blanket. Hovering, lighting, flicking away again as he twitched. He lay curled on the ground, wearing only a shirt, a water jug lying near his head. I knelt by him, peering as I touched him. His shirt and legs were stained, as was the grass where he lay. The excrement was very watery. Most had soaked into the soil by now, but there was some solid matter. He'd been stricken later than Hortense and the children then. His guts hadn't been griping long, or there would be mostly water tinged with blood. "Patrick?"
"Mrs. Clare, thank the Lord you've come."
His voice was so hoarse, I could scarcely make out words.
"My bairnies. Have you got my bairnies safe?"
He raised himself on one elbow, shaking, sweat plastering strands of grey hair to his cheeks. His eyes cracked open, trying to see me, but they were swelled to mere slits by the bites of deer flies. "I have them." I put a hand on him at once, squeezing to force reassurance into him. "Lie down, Patrick. Wait a moment while I tend them, then I'll see to you." He was very ill, but not in immediate danger. The children were.
"Dinna mind me," Patrick muttered. "Dinna mind."
He swayed, brushed at the flies that crawled on his face and chest, then groaned as cramp seized his belly again, doubling as though some massive hand had crushed him in its grip. I was already running back to the house. There were splashes of water in the dust of the path. Good. Brianna had come this way, hurrying. Amoebic dysentery, food poisoning, typhoid, typhus, cholera.
Please God, not that. All of those and a lot more were currently lumped together simply as the bloody flux in this time, and for obvious reasons. Not that it mattered in the short term. The immediate danger of all the diuretic diseases was simple dehydration. In the effort to expel whatever microbial invader was irritating the gut, the gastrointestinal tract simply flushed itself repeatedly, depleting the body of the water necessary to circulate blood, to eliminate wastes, to cool the body by means of sweat, to maintain the brain and membranes, the water necessary to maintain life. If one could keep a patient sufficiently hydrated by means of intravenous saline and glucose infusions, then the gut would, most likely, heal itself eventually, and the patient would recover. Without intravenous intervention, the only possibility was to administer fluids by mouth, or rectum, as quickly and as constantly as possible, for as long as it took. If one could. If the patient couldn't keep down even water. I didn't think the McNeils were vomiting. I didn't recall that smell among the others in the cabin. Probably not cholera, then. That was something. Brianna sat on the floor by the elder child, the little girl's head in her lap, pressing a cup against her mouth. Lizzie knelt by the hearth, face red with exertion as she kindled the fire. The flies were settling on the emotionless body of the woman on the bed, and Masali crouched over the limp form of the baby on her lap, frantically trying to rouse it to drink. Spilled water streaked her skirt. I could see the tiny head lolled back on her lap, water dribbling down a slack and horribly flattened cheek. "She can't," Masali was saying over and over. "She can't! She can't!" Disregarding my own advice about fingers, I ruthlessly thrust an index finger into the baby's mouth, prodding the palate for a gag reflex. It was there. The baby choked on the water in its mouth and gasped, and I felt the tongue close hard against my finger for an instant. Sucking. She was an infant, still breastfed, and suckling is the first of the instincts for survival. I whirled to look at the woman, but a glance at her flat breasts and sunken nipples was enough. Even so, I grabbed one breast, squeezing my fingers toward the nipple. Again, again. No. No droplets of milk showed on the brownish nipples, and the breast tissue was flabby in my hand. No water, no milk. Masali, grasping what I was about, seized the neck of her blouse and ripped it down, pressing the child to her own bared breast. The tiny legs were limp against her dress, toes bruised and curled like wilted petals. I was tipping back Hortense's face, dribbling water into her open mouth. From the corner of my eye, I saw Masali rhythmically squeezing her breast with one hand, an urgent massage to make the milk let down, even as my own fingers moved in an echo of the motion, massaging the unconscious woman's throat, urging her to swallow. Her flesh was slick with sweat, but most of it was mine. Trickles of perspiration were running down my back, tickling between my buttocks. I could smell myself, a strange metallic scent like hot copper. The throat moved in sudden peristalsis, and I took my hand away. Hortense choked and coughed. Then her head rolled to the side and her stomach heaved, sending its meager contents rocketing back up. I wiped the trace of vomit from her lips and pressed the cup to her mouth again. Her lips didn't move. The water filled her mouth and dribbled down her face and neck. Among the buzzing of the flies, I heard Lizzie's voice behind me, calm but abstracted, as though she spoke from a long way off. "Can you stop cursing, ma'am? It's only that the weans can hear you." I jerked round at her, only then realizing that I had in fact been repeating, "Bloody fucking hell," out loud, over and over as I worked. "Yes," I said. "Sorry." And turned back to Hortense. I got some water down her now and then, but not enough. Not nearly enough, given that her bowels were still trying to rid themselves of whatever troubled them. Bloody flux. Lizzie was praying. "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee." Brianna was murmuring something under her breath, urgent sounds of maternal encouragement. "Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus." My thumb was on the pulse of the carotid artery. I felt it bump, skip, and go on, jerking along like a cart with a missing wheel. Her heart was beginning to fail, arrhythmic. "Holy Mary, Mother of God." I slammed my fist down on the center of her chest, and then again and again, hard enough that the bed and the pale, splayed body quivered under the blows. Flies rose in alarm from the soaked straw, buzzing. "Oh, no," said Masali softly behind me. "Oh, no,
No, please.
I had heard that tone of disbelief before, of protest and appeal denied, and knew what had happened.
Pray for us sinners.
As though she too had heard, Hortense's head rolled suddenly to one side, and her eyes sprang open, staring toward the place where Massali sat, though I thought she saw nothing. Then the eyes closed, and she doubled suddenly onto one side, legs drawn up nearly to her chin, her head wrenched back, body tight in spasm, and then she suddenly relaxed. She wouldn't let her child go alone.
Bloody flux. Now, and at the hour of our death, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace.
Lizzie's soft voice went on mechanically, repeating her words of prayer as mindlessly as I had said mine earlier. I held Hortense's wrist, checking for the pulse, but it was a mere formality. Massali curled over the tiny body in grief, rocking it against her breast. Milk dripped from the swollen nipple, coming slowly, then faster, falling like white rain on the small, still face, futilely eager to nourish and sustain. The air was still stifling, still thick with odour and flies, and the sound of Lizzie's prayers, but the cabin seemed empty and curiously silent. There was a shuffling noise outside, the sound of something being dragged, a grunt of pain and dreadful exertion. Then the soft sound of falling, a gasp of breath. Patrick had made it back to his own doorstep. Brianna looked to the door, but she still held the older girl in her arms, still alive. I set down the limp hand that I held carefully and went to help. Chapter 61. A Noisome Pestilence. The days were growing shorter, but light still came early. The windows at the front of the house faced east, and the rising sun glowed on the scrubbed white oak of my surgery floor. I could see the brilliant bar of light advancing across the hand-hewn boards. Had I an actual timepiece, I could have calibrated the floor like a sundial, marking the seams between the boards in minutes. As it was, I marked them in heartbeats, waiting through the moments until the sun should have reached the counter where my microscope stood ready, slides and beaker beside it. I heard soft footsteps in the corridor, and Jamie pushed the door open with his shoulder, a pewter mug of something hot held in each hand, wrapped with rags against the heat.
"Kiamara ahau, mon chéri," he said softly,
and handed one to me, brushing a kiss against my forehead.
"How is it, then?"
"It could be worse."
I gave him a smile of gratitude, though it was interrupted by a yawn. I didn't need to tell him that Patrick and his elder daughter still lived. He would have known at once by my face if anything dire had happened. In fact, bar any complications, I thought both would recover. I had stayed with them all night, rousing them hourly to drink a concoction of honeyed water mixed with a little salt, alternating with a strong infusion of peppermint leaf and dogwood bark to calm the bowels. I lifted the mug, goosefoot tea, closing my eyes as I inhaled the delicate perfume and feeling the tight muscles of my neck and shoulders relax in anticipation. He had seen me twist my head to ease my neck. Jamie's hand came down on my nape, large and wonderfully warm from holding the hot tea. I gave a small moan of ecstasy at the touch, and he laughed low in his throat, massaging my sore muscles.
"Should you not be abed, Sassenach? You'll not have slept at all the night."
"Oh, I did. A bit."
I had dozed fitfully, sitting up by the open window, roused periodically by the startling touch on my face of the moths that flew in, drawn to the light of my candle. Mrs. Bug had come at dawn, though, fresh and starched, ready to take over the heavy nursing.
"I'll go lie down in a bit," I promised. "But I wanted to have a quick look first."
I waved vaguely toward my microscope, which stood assembled and ready on the table. Next to it were several small glass bottles plugged with twists of cloth, each containing a brownish liquid. Jamie frowned at them.
"Look at what?" he said.
He lifted his long, straight nose, sniffing suspiciously.
"Is that shit?"
"Yes, it is," I said, not bothering to stifle a jaw-cracking yawn. I had, as discreetly as possible, collected samples from Hortense and the baby, and later from my living patients as well. Jamie eyed them.
"Exactly what," he inquired cautiously, "are you looking for?"
"Well, I don't know," I admitted. "And in fact, I may not find anything, or anything I can recognize. But it's possible that it was either an amoeba or a bacillus that made the McNeils sick. And I think I would recognize an amoeba. They're quite big, relatively speaking," I added hastily.
"Why?"
His ruddy brows drew together, then lifted.
"Why?"
That was a better question than he knew. "Well, partly for the sake of curiosity," I admitted. "But also, if I do find a causative organism that I can recognize, I'll know a bit more about the disease, how long it lasts, for instance, and whether there are any complications to look out for, especially, and how contagious it is." He glanced at me, cup half raised to his mouth.
"Is it one you can catch?"
"I don't know," I admitted. "Though I'm fairly sure it is. I've been vaccinated against typhus and typhoid, but this doesn't look like either one of those, and there are no vaccines for dysentery or Giardia poisoning." The brows drew together and stayed that way, knotted as he sipped his tea. His fingers gave my neck a final squeeze and dropped away. I sipped cautiously at my own tea, sighing in pleasure as it gently scalded my throat and ran hot and comforting down into my stomach. Jamie lounged on his stool, long legs thrust out. He glanced down into the steaming cup between his hands.
"Do you think this tea is hot, Sassenach?" he asked.
I raised my own brows at that. Both cups were still wrapped in rags, and I could feel the heat seeping through to my palms. "I do," I said. "Why?" He lifted the mug and took a mouthful of tea, which he held for a moment before swallowing. I could see the long muscles move in his throat.
"Brina came into the kitchen whilst I was brewing the pot," he said. "She took down the basin and the pannikin of soup, and then she took a dipper of water steaming from the kettle and poured it over her hands, one and then the other."
He paused a moment.
"The water was boiling when I took it off the fire a moment before."
The mouthful of tea I'd taken went down crooked, and I coughed. "Did she burn herself?" I said, when I'd got my breath back.
"She did," he said, rather grimly. "She scrubbed herself from fingertips to elbows, and I saw the blister on the side of her hand where the water fell."
He paused for a moment, and his eyes met mine over the mugs, dark blue with worry. I took another sip of my unhoneyed tea. The room was cool enough, just past dawn, that my hot breath made tiny wisps of steam as I sighed. "Patrick's baby died in Masali's arms," I said quietly. "She held the other child. She knows it's contagious." And knowing, could not touch or pick up her own child without doing her best to wash away her fear. Jamie moved uneasily.
"Aye," he began, "but still..."
"It's different," I said, and put a hand on his wrist, as much for my own comfort as his. The transient coolness of the morning air touched face and mind alike, dispelling the warm tangle of dreams. The grass and trees were still lit with a chilly dawn glow, blue-shadowed and mysterious, and Jamie seemed a solid point of reference, fixed in the shifting light. "Different," I repeated. "For her, I mean." I took a breath of the sweet morning air, smelling of wet grass and morning glories. "I was born at the end of a war, the Great War, they called it, because the world had never seen anything like it.
I told you about it. My voice held a slight question, and he nodded, eyes fixed on mine, listening. The year after I was born, I said, there was a great epidemic of influenza. All over the world. People died in hundreds and thousands. Whole villages disappeared in the space of a week. And then came the other. My war. The words were quite unconscious, but hearing them, I felt the corner of my mouth twitch with irony. Jamie saw it, and a faint smile touched his own lips. He knew what I meant, that odd sense of pride that comes of living through a terrible conflict, leaving one with a peculiar feeling of possession. His wrist turned, his fingers wrapping tight around my own.
"And she has never seen plague or war," he said, beginning to understand.
"Never."
His voice held something odd, nearly incomprehensible to a man born a warrior, brought up to fight as soon as he could lift a sword, born to the idea that he must, he would, defend himself and his family by violence. An incomprehensible notion, but a rather wonderful one. Only his pictures, films, I mean. Television. That one he would never understand, and I couldn't explain. The way in which such pictures focused on war itself, bombs and planes and submarines, and the thrilling urgency of blood shed on purpose. A sense of nobility in deliberate death. He knew what battlefields were really like. Battlefields, and what came after them. The men who fought in those wars, and the women, they didn't die of the killing, most of them. They died like this. A lift of my mug toward the open window, toward the peaceful mountains, the distant hollow where Patrick McNeil's cabin lay hidden. They died of illness and neglect, because there wasn't any way to stop it.
"I've seen that," he said softly, with a glance at the stoppered bottles. "Plague and ague run rampant in a city. Half a regiment dead of flux."
"Of course you have."
Butterflies were rising among the flowers in the dooryard, cabbage whites and sulphur yellows. Here and there the great lazy sail of a late tiger swallowtail out of the shadow of the wood. My thumb still rested on his wrist, feeling his heartbeat, slow and powerful. Brianna was born 7 years after penicillin came into common use. She was born in America. Not this one. I nodded toward the window again. But that one. That will be. There it isn't usual for lots of people to die of contagious illness. I glanced at him. The light had reached his waist and glowed on the metal cup in his hand. "Do you remember the first person you knew of who had died?" His face went blank with surprise, then sharpened, thinking. After a moment, he shook his head.
"My brother was the first who was important, but I count others before him, surely."
"I can't remember either. My parents, of course, their deaths had been personal. But born in England, I had lived in the shadow of cenotaphs and memorials, and people just beyond the bounds of my own family died regularly. I had a sudden vivid memory of my father putting on a Homburg and dark coat to go to the baker's wife's funeral. Mrs. Briggs, her name had been. But she hadn't been the first. I knew already about death and funerals. How old had I been then? 4, perhaps? I was very tired. My eyes felt grainy from lack of sleep, and the delicate early light was brightening to full sun. I think Frank's was the first death Brianna ever experienced personally. Maybe there were others, I can't be sure. But the point is...
I see the point.
He reached to take the empty cup from my hand and set it on the counter, then drained his own and set it down too.
"But it's no herself she fears for, eh?"
he asked, his eyes penetrating.
"It's the wean."
I nodded. She would have known, of course, in an academic sort of way, that such things were possible. But to have a child die suddenly before you, from something like a simple case of diarrhea.
"She's a good mother," I said, and yawned suddenly. She was,
but it would never have struck her in any visceral way that something so negligible as a germ could suddenly snatch away her child. Not until yesterday. Jamie stood up suddenly and pulled me to my feet.
"Go to bed, Sassenach," he said. "That will wait."
He nodded at the microscope.
"I've never known shit spoil with keeping."
I laughed and collapsed slowly against him, my cheek pressed against his chest. "Maybe you're right." Still, I didn't push away. He held me, and we watched the sunlight grow, creeping slowly up the wall. Chapter 62. Amoeba. I turned the mirror of the microscope a fraction of an inch further to get as much light as I could. "There." I stepped back, motioning Malva to come and look. "Do you see it? The big clear thing in the middle, lobed with the little flecks in it?" She frowned, squinting one-eyed into the ocular, then drew in her breath in a gasp of triumph. "I see it plain. Like a currant pudding someone's dropped on the floor, no?" "That's it," I said, smiling at her description in spite of the general seriousness of our investigation. "It's an amoeba, one of the bigger sorts of microorganisms. And I very much think it's our villain." We were looking at slides made from the stool samples I had retrieved from all the sick so far. For Patrick's family was not the only one affected. There were three families with at least one person ill with a vicious bloody flux. And in all of the samples I had looked at so far, I had found this amoebic stranger. "Is it really?" Malva had looked up when I spoke, but now returned to the eyepiece, absorbed. "How can something so small cause such a stormash in something so big as a person?" "Well, there is an explanation," I said, swishing another slide gently through the dye bath and setting it to dry. "But it would take me a bit of time to tell you all about cells. You remember, I showed you the cells from the lining of your mouth." She nodded, frowning slightly, and ran her tongue along inside her cheek. "Well, the body makes all kinds of different cells, and there are special kinds of cells whose business it is to fight bacteria, the small, roundish sorts of things. You remember those?" I gestured at the slide, which, being fecal matter, had the usual vast quantities of Escherichia coli and the like. "But there are millions of different sorts, and sometimes a microorganism comes along that the special cells aren't able to deal with. You know, I showed you the plasmodium in Lizzie's blood." I nodded toward the stoppered vial on the counter. I had taken blood from Lizzie only a day or two before and shown the malarial parasites in the cells to Malva. "And I do think that this amoeba of ours may well be one like that." "Oh, well. Will we give the sick folk the penicillin, then?" I smiled a little at the eager "we," though there was little enough to smile at in the situation overall. "No, I'm afraid penicillin isn't effective against amoebic dysentery. That's what you call a very bad flux, a dysentery. No, I'm afraid we've nothing much to be going on with, save herbs." I opened the cupboard and ran an eye over the ranks of bottles and gauze-wrapped bundles, puzzling. "Wormwood, for a start." I took the jar down and handed it to Malva, who had come to stand beside me, looking with interest into the mysteries of the cupboard. "Garlic, that's generally useful for infections of the digestive tract, but it makes quite a good poultice for skin things as well. What about onions? My granny would steam an onion and put it to my ear when I was a wee bairn and had the earache. It smelt something dreadful, but it did work. It can't hurt. Run out to the pantry then and fetch, three big ones and several heads of garlic."
"Oh, at once, ma'am."
She set down the wormwood and dashed out, sandals flapping. I turned back to the shelves, trying to calm my own sense of urgency. I was torn between the urge to be with the sick, nursing them, and the need to make medicines that might be of help. But there were other people who could do the nursing, and no one but me who knew enough to try to compound an anti-parasitic remedy. "Wormwood, garlic, agrimony,
and gentian. Anything with a very high content of copper or sulphur. Oh, rhubarb. We were past the growing season, but I'd had a fine crop and had put up several dozen bottles of the boiled pulp and syrup, as Mrs. Bug liked it for pies, and it provided some vitamin C for the winter months. That would make a splendid base for the medicine. Add, perhaps, slippery elm, for its soothing effects on the intestinal tract. Though such effects were likely to be so slight as to be unnoticeable against the ravages of such a virulent onslaught. I began pounding wormwood and agrimony in my mortar, meanwhile wondering where the bloody hell the thing had come from. Amoebic dysentery was normally a disease of the tropics. Oh, God knew I'd seen any number of peculiar tropical diseases on the coast, brought in with the slave and sugar trade from the Indies, and not a few further inland, too, since any such disease that wasn't instantly fatal tended to become chronic and move along with its victim. It wasn't impossible that one of the fisherfolk had contracted it during the journey from the coast, and while being one of the fortunate persons who suffered only a mild infection, was now carrying the encysted form of the amoeba around in his or her digestive tract, all ready to shed infective cysts right and left. Why this sudden outbreak? Dysentery was almost always spread via contaminated food or water. What? Here, ma'am. Malva was back, breathless from her hurry, several large brown onions in hand, crackling and glossy, and a dozen garlic heads bundled in her apron. I set her to slicing them up, and had the happy inspiration of telling her to stew them in honey. I didn't know whether the antibacterial effect of honey would be likewise effective against an amoeba, but it couldn't hurt, and might conceivably make the mixture a little more palatable. It was shaping up to be more than a trifle eye-watering between the onions, the garlic, and the rhubarb. Phew! What are you guys doing in here? I looked up from my macerating to see Brianna in the door looking deeply suspicious, nose wrinkled against the smell. Oh, well, I'd become habituated to it myself, but in fact, the air in the surgery was fairly thick with the smell of fecal samples, now augmented by waves of onion fumes. Malva looked up, eyes streaming, and sniffed, wiping her nose on her apron. "We're making medicine," she informed Bree with considerable dignity. "Has anyone else fallen sick?" I asked anxiously. But she shook her head and edged into the room, fastidiously avoiding the counter where I had been making slides of fecal matter. "No, not that I've heard. I took some food over to the McLachlans this morning, and they said only the two little ones had it. Mrs. Kinyach said she'd had diarrhea a couple of days ago, but not bad, and she's all right now." "They're giving the little ones honey water." She nodded, a small frown between her eyebrows. "I saw them. They look pretty sick, but nothing like the McNeils." She looked rather sick herself at the memory, but shook it off, turning to the high cupboard. "Can I borrow a little sulfuric acid, Mama?" She'd brought an earthenware cup with her, and the sight of it made me laugh. "Ordinary people borrow a cup of sugar," I told her, nodding at it. "Of course. Be careful with it, though. You'd best put it in one of those vials with a waxed cork. You do not want to chance tripping and spilling it." "I definitely don't," she assured me. "I only need a few drops, though. I'm going to dilute it down pretty far. I'm making paper." "Paper?" Malva blinked, red-eyed, and sniffed. "How?" "Well, you squish up anything fibrous you can get your hands on," Bree told her, making squishing motions with both hands in illustration. "Old bits of used paper, old rags of cloth, bits of yarn or thread, some of the softer sorts of leaves or flowers. Then you soak the mash for days and days in water, and if you happen to have some, dilute sulfuric acid." One long finger tapped the square bottle affectionately. "Then, once the mash is all digested down to a sort of pulp, you can spread a thin layer of it on screens, press out the water, let it dry, and hey, presto,
paper! I could see Malva mouthing, hey presto, to herself, and turned away a little so she couldn't see me smile. Brianna uncorked the big square bottle of acid and very carefully poured a few drops into her cup. Immediately the hot smell of sulphur rose like a demon amidst the miasma of feces and onions. Malva stiffened, eyes still streaming, but wide.
"What is that?" she said.
"Sulfuric acid," Bree said, looking at her curiously. "Vitriol," I amended. "Have you seen, smelled it before?" She nodded, put the sliced onions into a pot, and put the lid neatly on.
"Aye, I have."
She came to look at the green glass bottle, dabbing at her eyes. "My mother, she died when I was young. She had some of that. I remember the smell of it, and how she'd say as I mustn't touch it, ever. Brimstone, folk called the smell. A whiff of brimstone."
"Really?
I wonder what she used it for."
I did wonder, and with a certain sense of unease. An alchemist or an apothecary might have the stuff. The only reason that I knew for a common citizen to keep it was as a means of aggression, to throw at someone. But Malva only shook her head, and turning, went back to the onions and garlic. I'd caught the look on her face, though, a queer expression of hostility and longing that rang a small, unsuspected bell somewhere inside me. Longing for a mother long dead, and the fury of a small girl abandoned, bewildered, and alone.
"What?"
Brianna was watching my face, frowning slightly.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing," I said, and put a hand on her arm just to feel the strength and joy of her presence, the years of her growth. Tears stung my eyes, but that could be put down to onions. "Nothing at all." I was getting terribly tired of funerals. This was the third in as many days. We had buried Hortense and the baby together, then the older Mrs. Ogilvy. Now it was another child, one of Mrs. McAvey's twins. The other twin, a boy, stood by his sister's grave in a shock so profound that he looked like a walking ghost himself, though the disease hadn't touched him. We were later than intended. The coffin hadn't been quite ready, and the night was rising around us. All the gold of the autumn leaves had faded into ash, and white mist was curling through the dark, wet trunks of the pines. One could hardly imagine a more desolate scene, and yet it was in a way more fitting than the bright sunshine and fresh breeze that had blown when we buried Hortense and little Angelica.
"The Lord is my shepherd. He leadeth me beside..."
Roger's voice cracked painfully, but no one seemed to notice. He struggled for a moment, swallowing hard, and went on doggedly. He held the little green Bible in his hands, but wasn't looking at it. He was speaking from memory, and his eyes went from Mr. Macduff standing alone, for his wife and his sister were both sick, to the little boy beside him, a little boy about Jemmy's age.
Though I walk through the valley of death, I shall fear no evil."
His voice was trembling audibly, and I saw that tears were running down his face. I looked for Bree. She was standing a little way behind the mourners, Jem half swaddled in the folds of her dark cloak. The hood of it was drawn up, but her face was visible, pale in the gloaming. Our Lady of Sorrows. Even Major MacDonald's red coat was muted, charcoal grey in the last vestiges of light. He had arrived in the afternoon and helped to carry up the little coffin. He stood now, hat somberly tucked beneath his arm, wigged head bowed, his face invisible. He too had a child, a daughter, somewhere back in Scotland with her mother. I swayed a little and felt Jamie's hand under my elbow. I'd been without sleep for most of the last 3 days, and had taken precious little food. I didn't feel either hungry or tired, though.
I felt remote and unreal, as though the wind blew through me. The father uttered a cry of inconsolable grief and sank down suddenly upon the heap of dirt thrown up by the grave. I felt Jamie's muscles contract in instinctive compassion toward him, and pulled away a little, murmuring, "Go." I saw him cross swiftly to Mr. McCaffey, bend to whisper to him, put an arm around him. Roger has stopped talking. My thoughts wouldn't obey me. Try as I might to fix them on the proceedings, they strayed away. My arms ached. I'd been pounding herbs, lifting patients, carrying water. I felt as though I were doing all these things over and over, could feel the repetitive thud of pestle in mortar, the dragging weight of fainting bodies. I was seeing in vivid memory the slides of entamoeba, greedy pseudopodia flowing in slow-motion appetite. Water. I heard water flowing. It lived in water, though only the cystic form was infective. It was passed on by means of water. I thought that very clearly. Then I was lying on the ground, with no memory of falling, no memory of ever being upright. The smell of fresh, damp dirt and fresh, damp wood strong in my nose, and a vague thought of worms. There was a flutter of motion before my eyes. The small green Bible had fallen and lay on the dirt in front of my face, the wind turning over its pages, one by one by one, in a ghostly game of Sortes Virgiliani. Where would it stop? I wondered dimly. There were hands and voices, but I couldn't pay attention. A great amoeba floated majestically in darkness before me, pseudopodia flowing slowly, slowly, in welcoming embrace. Chapter 63. Moment of Decision. Fever rolled across my mind like a thunderstorm, jagged forks of pain crackling through my body in bursts of brilliance, each a lightning bolt that glowed for a vivid moment along some nerve or plexus, lighting up the hidden hollows of my joints, burning down the length of muscle fibres. A merciless brilliance it struck again and again, the fiery sword of a destroying angel who gave no quarter. I seldom knew whether my eyes were open or closed, nor whether I woke or slept. I saw nothing but a roiling grey, turbulent and shot with red. The redness pulsed in veins and patches, shrouded in the cloud. I seized upon one crimson vein and followed its path, clinging to the track of its sullen glow amid the buffeting of thunder. The thunder grew louder as I penetrated deeper and deeper into the murk that boiled around me, becoming hideously regular, like the beating of a kettle drum, so that my ears rang with it, and I felt myself a hollow skin, tight-stretched, vibrating with each crash of sound. The source of it was now before me, throbbing so loudly that I felt I must shout, only to hear some other sound. But though I felt my lips draw back and my throat swell with effort, I heard nothing but the pounding. In desperation I thrust my hands, if they were my hands, through the misty grey and seized some warm, moist object, very slippery, that throbbed convulsing in my hands. I looked down and knew it all at once to be my own heart. I dropped it in horror, and it crawled away in a trail of reddish slime, shuddering with effort, the valves all opening and closing like the mouths of suffocating fish, each popping open with a hollow click, closing again with a small, meaty thud. Faces sometimes appeared in the clouds. Some seemed familiar, though I could put no name to them. Others were the faces of strangers, the half-seen, unknown faces that flit sometimes through the mind on the verge of sleep. These looked at me with curiosity or indifference, then turned away. The others, the ones I knew, bore looks of sympathy or worry. They would seek to fix my gaze with theirs, but my glance slid guiltily off, giddily away, unable to gain traction. Their lips moved, and I knew they spoke to me, but I heard nothing, their words drowned by the silent thunder of my storm. I felt quite odd, but for the first time in uncountable days, not ill. The fever clouds had rolled back, still grumbling softly somewhere near, but for the moment gone from sight. My eyes were clear. I could see the raw wood in the beams overhead. In fact, I saw the wood with such clarity that I was struck with awe at the beauty of it. The loops and whorls of the polished grain seemed at once static and alive with grace, the colours of it shimmering with smoke and the essence of the earth, so that I could see how the beam was transformed, and yet held still the spirit of the tree. I was so entranced by this that I reached out my hand to touch it, and did. My fingers brushed the wood with delight at the cool surface, and the grooves of the axe marks, wing-shaped and regular as a flight of geese along the beam. I could hear the beating of powerful wings, and at the same time feel the flex and swing of my shoulders, the vibration of joy through my forearms as the axe fell on the wood. As I explored this fascinating sensation, it occurred to me, dimly, that the beam was 8 feet above the bed. I turned, with no sense whatever of effort, and saw that I lay upon the bed below. I lay on my back, the quilts rumpled and scattered, as though I had tried at some point to throw them off, but lacked the strength to do so. The air in the room was strangely still, and the blocks of colour in the fabric glowed through it like jewels at the bottom of the sea, rich but muted. By contrast, my skin was the colour of pearls, bloodless pale and shimmering. And then I saw that this was because I was so thin, that the skin of face and limb pressed hard upon the bone, and it was the gleam of bone and cartilage below that gave that lustre to my face, smooth hardness shining through transparent skin. And such bones as they were! I was filled with wonder at the marvel of their shaping. My eyes followed the delicacy of the arching ribs, the heart-breaking beauty of the sculptured skull, with a sense of awed astonishment. My hair was tumbled, matted and snarled, and yet I felt myself drawn to it, tracing its curves with eye and finger, for I had no consciousness of moving, and yet I felt the softness of the strands, the cool silk of brown and the springing vibrancy of silver, heard the hairs chime softly past each other, a rustle of notes cascading like a harp's. "My God," I said, and heard the words, though no sound stirred the air. "You are so lovely." My eyes were open. I looked deep and met a gaze of amber and soft gold. The eyes looked through me to something far beyond, and yet they saw me too. I saw the pupils dilate slightly, and felt the warmth of their darkness embrace me with knowledge and acceptance. "Yes," said those knowing eyes, "I know you. Let us go." I felt a sense of great peace, and the air around me stirred, like wind rushing through feathers. Then some sound turned me toward the window, and I saw the man who stood there. I had no name for him, and yet I loved him. He stood with his back turned to the bed, arms braced on the sill, and his head sunk on his chest, so the dawn light glowed red on his hair and traced his arms with gold. A spasm of grief shook him. I felt it, like the tremblers of a distant quake. Someone moved near him, a dark-haired woman, a girl. She came close, touched his back, murmuring something to him. I saw the way she looked at him, the tender inclination of her head, the intimacy of her body swaying toward him. "No," I thought, with great calm, "that won't do." I looked once more at myself lying on the bed, and with a feeling that was at once firm decision and incalculable regret, I took another breath. Chapter 64
I am the Resurrection.
Part 2 I still slept for long periods, waking only briefly to take nourishment. Now the fever dreams were gone, though, and sleep was a lake of deep black water, where I breathed oblivion and drifted past the waving waterweed, mindless as a fish. I would float sometimes just below the surface, aware of people and things in the air-breathing world, but incapable of joining them. Voices spoke near me, muffled and meaningless. Now and then, some phrase would penetrate the clear liquid around me and float into my head, where it would hang like a tiny jellyfish, round and transparent, yet pulsating with some mysterious inner meaning, its words a drifting net. Each phrase hung for a time in my purview, folding and unfolding in its curious rhythms, and then drifted quietly up and away, leaving silence. And in between the small jellyfish came open spaces of clear water, some filled with radiant light, some the darkness of utter peace. I drifted upward and downward, suspended between the surface and the depths, at the whim of unknown currents. Physician, look. Fizz. A stirring there. Some dormant spore of consciousness disturbed by carbonation, splits and booms. Then a stab as sharp as metal. Who is calling me? Physician, look. I opened my eyes. It was no great shock, for the room was filled with twilight, still light, like being underwater, and I had no sense of disruption.
O Lord Jesus Christ, thou great physician, look with thy gracious favour upon this thy servant. Give wisdom and discretion to those who minister to her in her sickness. Bless all the means used for her recovery.
The words flowed past me in a whispering stream, cool on my skin. There was a man before me, dark head bent over a book. The light in the room embraced him, and he seemed part of it.
"Stretch forth thy hand,"
he whispered to the pages, in a voice that cracked and broke.
"And according to thy will, restore her to health and strength, that she may live to praise thee for thy goodness and thy grace, to the glory of thy holy name. Amen."
"Roger," I said, groping for his name. My own voice was hoarse from disuse. Speaking was an intolerable effort. His eyes were closed in prayer. They sprang open, unbelieving. And I thought how vivid they were, the green of wet serpentine and summer leaves.
"Claire!"
His voice cracked like a teenaged boy's, and he dropped the book. "I don't know," I said, feeling the dreamlike sense of submergence threatening to engulf me again. "Am I?" I could lift a hand for a moment or two, but was too weak even to lift my head, let alone sit up. Roger helpfully dragged me semi-upright against piled pillows and put his hand at the back of my head to prevent wobbling, holding a cup of water to my dry lips. It was the odd feel of his hand on the bare skin of my neck that began a dim process of realization. Then I felt the warmth of his hand, vivid and immediate at the back of my head, and jerked like a gaffed salmon, sending the cup flying.
"What? What?"
I spluttered, clutching my head, too shocked to formulate a complete sentence, and oblivious to the cold water soaking through the sheets.
"What?"
Roger looked nearly as shocked as I felt. He swallowed, searching for words.
I thought you knew," he stammered, voice breaking. "Didn't you? I mean, I thought, look, it'll grow."
I could feel my mouth working, vainly trying different shapes that might approximate words. But there was no connection between tongue and brain. There was room for nothing but the realization that the accustomed soft, heavy weight of my hair was gone, replaced by a fuzz of bristles.
"Malva and Mrs. Bug cut it off day before yesterday," Roger said, all in a rush. We weren't here, Bree nor I. We wouldn't have let them, of course, we wouldn't. But they thought it's what you do for someone with a terrible fever. It is what people do now. Bree was furious with them, but they truly thought they were helping save your life. Oh, God, Claire, don't look like that, please.
His face had disappeared in a starburst of light, a curtain of shimmering water suddenly coming down to protect me from the gaze of the world. I wasn't conscious of crying at all. Grief simply burst from me like wine spraying from a wineskin stabbed with a knife.